I'm Mary Nichols. I'm Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's a real pleasure to welcome you again, this time, though, to the season finale of Headliners. We've had a great time with this program this season, and I hope you have as well. Since last October, we've heard from experts at the center of some of this year's most interesting stories. Together, we've discussed topics ranging from the war in the Middle East, where we started this, Somalia, to the national debates over stem cell research and renewable energy, to the national debates over, to the growing trend of social networking on the internet. That was particularly eye-opening for me, I think. Each month's discussion has been shaped by your terrific participation and insights, and I really want to thank you for that, those of you who have been here several times before, and I know many of you have. So as we look forward to next year's season, we're turning to you to help us shape this program in at least two ways. First, we ask you to please fill out the and return to us the short survey about your headliner's experience this year. And secondly, we're hoping that many of you will stay for about a half hour after tonight's presentation and discussion with Jane Kirtley to discuss not only headliners, but another new initiative that we're planning to launch next year. So if you have an opportunity to stay for a few more minutes afterwards, about a half hour afterwards, I invite you to do so. So while this is the end of the headliner season, the first headliner season, there are several other exciting opportunities available to you during the summer. Tonight, you'll find information out in the lobby about several of them, and they include the Great Conversations Lecture Series, which is ongoing now and continues through June, a spring Complete Scholar set of short courses, which begin next week and run through May, 20 one-day-long curiosity camps. It's a summer camp for adult learners beginning in June on the premise of kids shouldn't have all the fun during the summer. And then the nationally renowned Split Rock Arts Program, which is offering 38 workshops in writing, visual art, and design. We hope to see you at some of these continuing education programs this summer, and we sure hope you'll join us again in October for another new season of Headliners. Tonight's speaker has participated in many of these outreach programs with us at the University of Minnesota. She's also a regular commentator on NPR, on First Amendment rights and the ethical and legal responsibilities of the news media. Last month, Lewis Scooter Libby was convicted on felony charges related to the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA agent to the press. But as the trial ended, a complicated debate was just beginning on how journalism is practiced in the nation's capital. While most people in the country didn't really care about the identity of one CIA operative, they were very concerned by what appeared to be an effort by the White House to discredit a prominent critic of its policies in Iraq by systematically leaking information to the press. The Libby trial ultimately exposed damaging information about the relationship between the Washington Press Corps and the government they are there to cover. Tonight, we're very fortunate to have one of this country's leading experts on the media to talk about the impact of this relationship on our access to this important information. Jane Kirtley has been the director of the Silhas Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law since 1999. She holds a master's degree in journalism from Northwestern and a law degree from Vanderbilt University, and has worked as both an attorney and a reporter. Prior to joining the University of Minnesota faculty, Jane served for 14 years as the executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, an association dedicated to protecting the First Amendment and freedom of information interests of the news media. She writes and speaks frequently on these issues, both here and abroad, and appears regularly on nationally broadcast news programs. She's received numerous distinguished awards for her work, including the John Peter Zenger Award for Freedom of the Press, the People's Right to Know Award from the University of Arizona, and the First Amendment Matrix Foundation Award from the Association for Women in Communications. In 1996, she was inducted into the Freedom of Information Hall of Fame. So please join me in welcoming Professor Jane Kirtley. Jane.
Thank you. That's such a warm welcome. And when a topic is as explosive as the one I'll be talking about tonight, I hope you're equally warm as I leave tonight. And I hope you'll bear with me because I'm fighting off spring allergies, so I may lose my voice at some point. So if you can't hear me, please put your hand up because I might drop my voice without realizing I'm doing it. I guess there's some symmetry, isn't there, to the way headliners began last fall and the way it's ending, because it seems as if you started with the war and in a way we're ending with the war here today. Timing, it really is everything, and it is purely coincidental that I happened to be in Columbus, Ohio, doing a program for, of all groups, the Federalist Society, on the day that Scooter Libby was convicted. And the topic, not surprisingly, was reporters' privilege to protect confidential information. This is a really hot topic in journalistic circles, and I sense that it also is among you, the consumers of news and information, as it is provided to you by the mainstream press and others. But I think I would be deficient in my discussion tonight if I didn't also mention that it's really timely to have this topic today, because as I'm sure many of you know, an individual by the name of Josh Wolf, a blogger and also a self-described anarchist, has just been released from prison in California, having served the longest time in prison of any journalist in the United States for refusing to cooperate with authorities and turn over unpublished information. Josh's case was very controversial, especially, I would say, in journalistic circles because of the ambiguous nature of who he is and what he's about. If you know anything about his case, you know that it arose because he had been covering some demonstrations, or at least I should say he'd been saying he'd been covering some demonstrations that were taking place in conjunction with the G8 summit, which was taking place in Scotland, but the demonstrations were here in the United States. During the course of the demonstrations, things got ugly, as sometimes happens, and some individuals started attacking people, and a police car was rolled over and attempted to be set on fire. In a rather peculiar set of circumstances after the fact, the federal government got involved in the investigation in connection with what had transpired there, ostensibly because they said federal money had gone to help purchase the police car, so this made it a federal case. Now, as you heard, I'm a lawyer. I've never quite heard of that particular legal theory, but it seemed to survive to the point of the convening of a federal grand jury in San Francisco, which, among other things, is a nice way to put it, demanded that Josh Wolf turn over the videotape that he had shot for the purposes of identifying protesters and others who had been involved in the violence was the way it was characterized. Josh Wolf took the position that they really weren't interested in getting the identity of the individuals who had engaged in illegal acts, that what they really wanted to do was to identify those who were engaging in peaceful and lawful protest. And so he refused to cooperate. Now, again, what made his situation a little ambiguous was the fact that, as I said, he describes himself as an anarchist, and there was a clear question as to whether he was at this demonstration in his capacity as an anarchist or as his capacity as a blogger. The position that the federal government took was, of course, that he was not a journalist. But the position that was taken by many in the journalism community was that he was indeed a journalist, that he was doing what journalists do, that is, gathering information for the purposes of disseminating it to the general public. And, you know, therein was ultimately the conflict, because although he was represented by an extremely able team of lawyers out in California, and I would add, if he had been prosecuted, or I shouldn't say prosecuted, but if he had been subject to this subpoena in California state court, I don't think there's much doubt that he would have been granted a privilege not to provide his video. There had been a ruling in the California state courts just a few months before his case arose, where the court specifically said that the California Shield Law protected bloggers like Josh Wolf. But he wasn't in state court. He was in federal court, and the federal court said, we don't really care what the California law says. We're only dealing with federal law. Now, Think back. What does that mean, federal law? Well, we know what that means a lot more clearly today than we did about 3 years ago because of the Judith Miller case. I don't think I have to remind you what transpired in the Judith Miller case, but I will just say this about it. One of the things that did come out in that case was a very clear question about whether a journalist who has ostensibly witnessed criminal activity has a privilege under the First Amendment to the Constitution not to testify before a grand jury. This is not a novel question. The Supreme Court had actually answered that question back in 1972 in a case called Brandsburg versus Hayes. The facts were different, but the central legal question was exactly the same. And the Supreme Court, in a very fractured opinion that people are still puzzling over, held that in that narrow set of circumstances, a journalist had no privilege under the First Amendment. If you ever go back and read the case, you'll see that the court talks at length about its skepticism, shall we say, that the lack of a First Amendment privilege really would impede journalism, the practice of journalism as we know it in this country. There were dissenting opinions by some predictable members of the court, now no longer with us, such as Justice Hugo Black, popularly regarded as a First Amendment absolutist, who said that, of course, the First Amendment should protect journalists from being turned into agents of the government. But that was not the rule that the majority adopted. So, for many years after that, you will think, oh, gee, that must mean journalists were constantly being hauled into court and then thrown into jail. But in fact, that didn't happen. Why not? Well, it's a very simple reason, actually two simple reasons. One was because some very creative media lawyers, including Jim Goodell, who at that time had represented the New York Times in private practice, basically said, yes, it's true that the court doesn't recognize a privilege in that particular set of circumstances, but they left the door open to recognize a confidential source privilege in any other situation. So for about 30 years, we had courts around the country, both federal and state, saying, yeah, there is, in fact, a First Amendment privilege in other circumstances, and that served the press very well. In addition to that, in the years after Brandsburg, a lot of the states that had not already enacted Reporter Shield laws, including this state, Minnesota, did pass such laws. And at the moment, we actually have 32 states plus the District of Columbia that have statutory shield laws. The other thing, though, and this may seem counterintuitive, and a lot of people aren't aware of it, is that during the Nixon administration, his then Attorney General, John Mitchell, issued some guidelines that were to govern whether when and under what circumstances the Department of Justice and its branches would have the authority to subpoena a journalist. And it set a very, very high bar. I'm going to just summarize it, but basically what the guidelines say is that, number one, going to a journalist should be a last resort. Number two, if you go to a journalist, you should first negotiate to see if you can persuade the journalist to provide you with what you need without going through the force of law. If that doesn't work, then you should tailor the subpoena to make it as narrow as possible so that only the material that is absolutely essential to the government's case would be sought. And finally, and here is the thing that had made the difference, anybody who wanted to subpoena a journalist under these circumstances had to go to the Attorney General and get his or her written permission to go forward. So in other words, somebody practicing U.S. attorney out in Idaho or something couldn't just decide, okay, I'm going to subpoena a journalist. He or she would have to go back to Washington and get the permission of the Attorney General. The consequence of this was that Republican administration, Democratic administration, different attorney generals, it didn't matter. Year in, year out, since about 1975, we've had these attorney general guidelines in place, and they've worked, from the press's perspective, extremely well. The number of subpoenas served on the press by the federal government, you could literally count on the fingers of one hand in any given year. So with all of this largesse, it was actually pretty easy for the press to not pay a lot of attention to the Brandsburg versus Hayes case. And then with the Judith Miller situation, that house of cards all came crashing down. What we had as a result of the Judith Miller case were some unequivocal rulings by several federal courts saying You know, guys, there is no First Amendment privilege under these circumstances. Journalists have an obligation, just as anybody else would have an obligation, to testify before a grand jury if they have material that would be helpful to the grand jury in its deliberations. And it doesn't matter if they made a promise of confidentiality to their source. Now, that's the other piece of this, isn't it? The promise of confidentiality. Think back, if you can, to Robert Novak's original column where he first outed Valerie Plame. He did not, of course, identify his source at that time. And I remember when I was writing a column for American Journalism Review shortly after it, I said, and I don't think this gets me any big prizes for my ability to foresee what was going to happen. It was pretty predictable. I said, you know, he's saying, as he was saying at the time, that he's not going to reveal his confidential source. But he says that from the very comfortable position of looking at these 30-odd years of precedent and being relatively confident that the government's not going to force his hand. But what I think he hadn't counted on was the fact that we brought in Patrick Fitzgerald to bring this action. And guess what? Patrick Fitzgerald says, I'm not subject to these attorney general guidelines. I can do pretty much whatever I want, which is what he did. And why he proceeded to go after not only Judith Miller, but a number of other journalists, both famous and less famous, in his attempts to try to get the information he needed to secure his indictment, which ultimately led to the Scooter Libby trial. Now, if you followed the trial, you know that in addition to all of these skirmishes involving reporters' privilege, and I shouldn't probably use the word skirmish when that includes a reporter going to jail for 85 days, you may remember that this whole issue of confidentiality sort of came to a head when we discovered that a lot of these journalists were willing, at least under coercion, to go in and testify in the Scooter Libby trial. Some of them were prosecution witnesses. Some of them were defense witnesses. But they were all put in the position of basically turning as evidence, purveyors of evidence, in these trials, which is a position that journalists really don't like to be in. You could say nobody does, but I can tell you journalists really don't like to do it. The interesting thing about it, from my perspective as a lawyer that used to represent journalists, is I always used to try to persuade people that were trying to subpoena journalists that it was really kind of a stupid thing to do, not because of the shield laws, not because of the reporter's privilege, but because for the most part, journalists don't make terribly good witnesses. If you followed the trial, you know that a lot of the journalists didn't recall, couldn't remember, and you are laughing and chuckling, and I am too, but I have to tell you that for the most part, I believe them when they say that. And the reason that I do is because journalists cover hundreds and hundreds of stories in the course of a career, some of them thousands. And the likelihood that they're going to remember in detail a chance conversation with a particular source is really not very high. So I think anybody who wants to put a journalist on the stand really has to try to calculate whether the evidence they're going to get from that journalist is really going to be that helpful, assuming that's their goal. Another way to look at this, of course, if you really are a conspiracy theorist, is to think that this was a highly structured, very clever ploy to essentially devalue the press, to make the press look less competent than it is, to make the press look less reliable than it is, and to uncover the dirty little secret of Washington, D.C. journalism, which anybody who spent any time there knows very well, which is that journalists and sources have a symbiotic relationship that, frankly, does not always serve the interest of the public. I think, as somebody who teaches both law and ethics, that it is very problematic when a journalist routinely grants a promise of confidentiality to a source. And one of the things that came out in the Libby trial is that there are at least some journalists in Washington, D.C., who will grant confidentiality without it even being asked for by the source. They'll just start off with the assumption that, of course, the source wants this to be off the record, deep background, or whatever the case may be. I think this is an appalling practice, if only because it disserves the interest of the reader and the viewer. If you don't know what the source of the information is, how can you possibly make an evaluation about whether what the source is asserting is credible or not? Now, you can, as a journalist, counterbalance that, if you use a leak like that or a revelation like that essentially as your way to pry the information loose from a source that you can't identify, maybe that's through public records, maybe that's through filing a Freedom of Information Act request, who knows? But the point is, the goal, I think, is always to get the information on a source that, from a source that you can identify publicly. If you can't do that, then I think you have to think long and hard about how good this is, how good a practice this is in terms of serving the interests of the people you're supposed to be thinking about, which are your readers and viewers, the public. Having said that, I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that I'm indicting the notion of using leaks as always the wrong practice or the wrong way to go. In his memoir, The Politics of Truth, Joseph Wilson, Valerie Plame's husband, made the following comments. When is a leaker a true whistleblower, risking his personal security to inform the citizenry and preserve the public's interest? And when is a leaker a mendacious opportunist, out to advance the narrow interests of himself or his boss? When does a leaker become so appalled at the self-serving actions of his colleagues that he crosses the line to shine a light on them? Is there a reliable way to distinguish among the many varieties of that genus, peculiarly indigenous to Washington, the leaker? And, of course, that's it, isn't it? That's the problem. And, again, as a lawyer, and I always kind of fall back to the way I look at these questions as a lawyer, I think of this in the context of the attorney-client privilege. As a lawyer, if I'm talking to a client, then I have the right, and indeed I have the ethical duty, to maintain the confidences that that client provides to me. It's to benefit the client, at least principally, but we could also say it's to benefit the interests of justice, the interests of society, because we want to encourage that individuals have full assistance of counsel without concern that their counsel will be called upon to betray them. That makes sense, and it's something that we've accepted for a long time here in the United States. Priest penitent, doctor patient, same idea. It benefits the patient, the client, the customer. But think about the reporter's privilege issue for a minute. Who's being benefited there? Is it a benefit to the source? Well, perhaps. Collaterally, it's a benefit to the source. But I would argue, and others have argued with me about this, but I still maintain, that ultimately the reporter's privilege is really there to protect the reporter's interest. So when you think back to what transpired during the Judith Miller controversy, when Patrick Fitzgerald was getting waivers from a variety of sources who ostensibly said it was fine with them if the reporter now outed them in testimony, you can understand why I at least would say that really doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to me whether it's okay with the source for the reporter to testify at this point. The question is whether the reporter can continue to do his or her work if they are asked to become essentially state's evidence. And I would argue that they can't, that it is not possible to serve two masters. You cannot be an arm of the government and also be the watchdog of the government. And therein lies the rub, doesn't it? Because for a lot of people, the bottom line goes back to what I was saying at the outset. Journalists, like anybody else, not entitled to special privileges, shouldn't expect special privileges, should be prepared to testify if it will be helpful to the institution of justice. And I think that that is ultimately where the conflict will lie. Because as we're now in an era where press bashing has risen to a new height, I thought it was bad during the Nixon era, but it pales by comparison to what is going on now. Whether from the right or from the left, the press is constantly being assailed, constantly being called into question. Its motives are always suspect, and its motivations for publishing the things that it does always questioned. It isn't just the old line about you only do it to sell newspapers or get higher ratings. Some even question the press's patriotism. There was a lot of language being thrown around the last 4 or 5 years about certain journalistic publications being traitorous, treasonous. And, you know, this is not something that just came out immediately post 9/11. It's happened again just within the last year over Pulitzer Prize revelations in the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's not easy, I think, for journalists and news organizations to try to buck that kind of opposition and that kind of criticism, especially when you have courts that presently seem to be extremely hostile to the old lines that we were so happy to have back in the 1970s and 80s from courts that seemed so convinced that the press was serving a valuable function and indeed did need to have special privileges. The problem, or a problem, that we now face that is really different than it was in 1972, though, is however you may feel about the press, in order to formulate how you feel about the press, you first have to define who the press is. It was a lot easier to define the press in 1972, I would suggest to you, than it is today in 2007. We can say that the mainstream media are the press. We can suggest that perhaps bloggers are or are not the press. But ultimately, who is going to decide? The Supreme Court doesn't want to decide. They've made that abundantly clear. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions of the last 200 years, you will search in vain for a definition of the press. And I don't think that that is simply because everybody knew what they meant by the term press. I think it's because the court recognizes, at least intuitively, if not affirmatively, that to define the press is ultimately to destroy the press as we know it here in this country. We don't license the news media. Anybody who wants to be a journalist can be. But the problem with that, from the perspective of those who oppose federal legislation to create a privilege, is that if, in fact, anybody with a computer and a modem is a journalist, then pretty soon nobody will be subject to subpoenas, nobody will testify in court, and our whole criminal justice system will come crashing down. Now, I don't happen to share that Armageddon kind of scenario because, again, I think although the court has never defined the press, I think implicitly it has done so in this way. It has looked at what the individual is doing. Has the individual gone out to gather information for the purposes of disseminating it to the public? And if that individual has, then that individual is doing journalism. This is not rocket science. It is pretty easy to do. And I think that some approach along those lines will be the way to solve what everybody is saying is the thorny, difficult problem, but to me is ultimately a red herring, which is trying to define who is a journalist. What I think about a lot more is not so much how we're going to define who is a journalist, but how we're going to define journalism in 2007. What does it mean? Does it mean nonstop 24/7 Anna Nicole Smith? Does it mean exposing mistakes or lies or both about the existence of weapons of mass destruction? What is journalism? And what is it what purpose is it intended to serve? I think that it's impossible to define journalism without an element that we don't hear very much about these days, in these, frankly, profit-obsessed days that we see, which is altruism. I think true journalism really is a calling. It sounds corny, I suppose, to say it, but I believe it sincerely that the role of a journalist is absolutely essential to any kind of democratic society. And if we lose sight of that, either the practitioners of journalism or the consumers of journalism, then I think we really face the possibility that our democratic system is going to cease to function in the way that we have expected it to. I'll just conclude with one other thought from an author who actually is also a friend of mine. Probably many of you are very familiar with him. Nat Hentoff writes frequently in The Village Voice and elsewhere. He made the comment in a column he wrote last November that it is, and I'm quoting here, it is in the nature of free speech that it is easily discouraged. And I think we sometimes forget that here in the United States because we have such a rich and long tradition of freedom of expression being held to such a high standard. You'll often hear people say there's a reason it's the First Amendment, but of course historians of the Bill of Rights know that the reason actually is that another amendment was eliminated in the process. And it's really just kind of coincidental that the First Amendment, those 45 words that guarantee us the right to speak freely to assemble, to petition the government, to practice our religion and so forth, and as well as protect the freedom of the press, is so essential and so central to what we're all about that we just kind of take it for granted. I think that it's also important to note that although I hope that this is shifting a little bit, there has been a period in this post 9/11 culture where people really did buy into the idea that certain kinds of speech were just too dangerous to be tolerated. And that, I think, is a sad reflection on the fact that periodically in this nation, we have gone through these periods of what I would characterize as insanity, where we think that speech is incredibly dangerous. Mostly these days, it seems to me, the speech we think is dangerous is that with which we disagree. But with Voltaire, I would have to say that it is far more dangerous to suppress those dissenting views. And I think you have only to look at the countries around the world that have gone or are trying to evolve from autocracy to democratic systems to see how important it is to ensure that free expression is there, if only as a safety valve to prevent the kind of strife, sectarian strife and others that we see in so many parts of the world. So I applaud the right of free speech for each and every one of us. I'd absolutely support the right of each and every one of us to call ourselves a journalist. The danger is, I think, if the legislature or the courts decide that it's part of their role to engage in that process. I don't know what technology is going to look like 10 years, 15 years, 20 years from now, but what I do know, as surely as I'm standing here, is that it really shouldn't matter at the least what my method of speaking is, whether I'm the lonely pamphleteer that one of the justices referred to in Brandsburg versus Hayes, standing on the corner handing out my broadsheets, or whether I'm publishing online on the internet and speaking to the world. It seems to me that I'm a soldier in the fight to keep our system functioning and to keep our republic strong. Thank you. And now I believe in the exercise of freedom of speech, you get to start raising your concerns and asking questions, and I wanted to be as brief as possible so we'd have as much time for that as we could. So please have at it.
Well, if they have as many questions on their sheet of paper as I do, this is going to go. This is always a really wonderful part. We've got a terrific audience. We're going to bring mics around to you because we're recording this. So it will go up on the web.
You brought up the name of Judith Miller, and I agree it's unfortunate she had to spend 80-plus days in jail. Excuse me. But there is another, perhaps more serious issue that was raised with regard to Judith Miller, as some saw her as serving as somewhat of a publicist mm-hmm. for the administration and promoting the cause of the Iraqi war. Now, do you see that there is any ethical guideline that she may have circumvented or breached in some way that led, for example, to her dismissal from the New York Times?
That's a very leading question. I don't know if you're a lawyer, but it's a very leading question. Of course there are ethical issues that were raised, not just by Judith Miller's conduct, but by that of other journalists who have been covering government since time immemorial. I think that We have to look at the Judith Miller situation, though, in the very specific context in which it arose, as well as looking at it as a general proposition. And when I say this specific context, I mean this. You heard before, when you heard my long and boring biography, that one of the things I've been very interested in for many years has been freedom of information. And I have to tell you, as an observer and as a scholar, that the administration that is in power has had some of the most draconian policies on access to government information of any that I've had any experience with, again, going back to the Nixon administration. There have been other administrations that have been secretive, but it's been raised to an art form in the current administration. And when I say secretive, I mean it in two respects. One, through the closing down of traditional channels of access, the Freedom of Information Act, affirmative disclosure by government agencies, and so on. That's significant, and I want to underscore that. But the other thing is that the Bush administration had been incredibly effective up until just a couple of years ago in controlling the leaks that were endemic in so many other administrations. There are lots of theories about that, and I'll leave it to political scientists who are more knowledgeable than I to explain what that is. But the bottom line was that there was a perception among many Washington journalists that if they were not basically going along with the administration, that they were going to be denied access and they would not have the ability to report anything at all. I think they were wrong in that. I think that it was the wrong decision to make. I think that they should have followed the great tradition of I.F. Stone, a name that many of you probably know, who very proudly said, you know, I don't go to press conferences. I don't follow the conventional channels. I just do my homework. I just do my work myself. Which is so important because remember I mentioned that the value of a leak is ultimately how it can lead you to those on the record kinds of information. And I think Judith Miller's failure in this situation was that instead of pursuing the alternative sources that could have given greater accuracy and balance to her reporting, she chose instead to rely upon those close to the administration who would speak to her. And that is a very unfortunate choice for a journalist to make.
Thank you. Over here on this side.
Yes. My question is this. What mechanics currently exist and maybe what should exist for the world of journalism, especially in the United States, to be able to control and patrol itself so that when certain journalists are acting outside of out of the ethical or moral pale, that there is some adjustments made by way of reflection or whatnot to identify these individuals and, in fact, shine a light on them from inside so that there is some sense of self-regulation.
Well, I guess I would say that I think a lot of that goes on now. And in fact, there are those in journalistic circles who accuse the media of engaging in too much navel gazing where they are engaging in constant analysis and Monday morning quarterbacking on the ethical decisions that their colleagues and competitors make. I can tell you, speaking again for myself, that at the Silla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law, one of the things we look at is that question. And I can tell you, too, that there are a variety of voluntarily membership organizations here in the United States. The Society of Professional Journalists is one, but there are others that are geared to specific types of media, like the Radio Television News Directors Association and the National Press Photographers Association, all of which have codes or standards of ethics and ethical conduct. And if you go to a website, www.poynter.org, and follow the links to a regular thing that appears there every day called Romanesco, you'll see that I would say probably 80% of the stories and links that he provides have to do with journalism ethics issues, whether it's the sale and acquisition of media outlets like the sale of the Tribune Company that just happened within the last 24 hours or so, or whether it's, I just saw a story this evening as I was coming over here, a newspaper in Topeka, Kansas, I believe, is pulling down some photographs that it discovered its photographer had manipulated, and they said, this is not our standard, we don't do that here. There's lots of that going on, and I sometimes, again, it's interesting because I see so much of it, and I'm always fascinated by it, that the general public doesn't seem to be aware that it's going on. Isn't being done in backroom tribunals. The newspapers are publishing this. It's appearing in their regular newspapers. It's appearing in the journalism magazines like American Journalism Review and Columbia Journalism Review. Slate, Jack Schaefer, has a regular column in which he constantly does this. So there's plenty of criticism going on, and I think that that's all to the good. Plus, of course, there are a variety of news organizations that have either readers' representatives or ombudsmen, ranging from the New York Times to the Minneapolis Star Tribune to NPR, who would be happy to hear your comments and criticisms and to reflect on them and to write about them. Now, having said all that, and I think all of this is really valuable and very important, and I also would point out that I think one big difference between journalism and other kind of institutions in this country is that, unlike many other in the private and public sector, when journalism, you know, journalists make a mistake and screw up, there it is. You know, it's in the daily paper. It's on the nightly news. And there's every opportunity for you, for bloggers, for anybody else to criticize the things that you don't like and that you don't appreciate. And oftentimes you will see the news organization, or if not the organization, their competitors, immediately analyzing that and talking about that. It's a very transparent institution as compared to at least many of the others that we have. Having said all that, though, I would also say that I would be opposed to any kind of system set up by journalists where they were basically disbarring reporters from the practice of journalism. And I say that as a lawyer who, you know, could be disbarred if I didn't follow the legal canons of ethics that I'm required to follow. And the reason I say that is because ultimately, when I look at sort of the universe of journalism ethics, I've been studying it for a long time, I come to the conclusion that I can really only come up with one journalistic ethical principle that I think all journalists would agree with. And that is that a journalist should never knowingly tell an untruth. And I think everything else is subject to debate and to discussion. And I would never want there to be a situation where we were like other countries where, in fact, journalists can be prevented from the practice of journalism because, as you would expect, sadly, those kinds of disbarment are frequently done for political reasons.
Jane, I'm always interested in students. They're the next generation of the people who are going to practice this. Could you say a little bit about what students coming into programs into the university think about this profession of journalism, and what are the big questions they're asking and the things that they're grappling with as they see this parade of issues that us grown-ups are having in the paper all the time?
Well, I think one of the biggest concerns that students that are hoping to pursue journalistic careers is, how in the world am I going to support myself if I do this? Journalism as a trade has never been highly paid. I mean, despite what you hear about the multi-million-dollar salaries of somebody like a Katie Couric, most journalists don't really make very much money, either in their starting jobs or in their lifetime, their career. So anybody who's entering journalism because they think they're going to make a lot of money doing it, traditional journalism, is kidding themselves, and I think any number of their professors would be happy to disabuse them of that idea. But I think most of our students are very pragmatic, and they understand that what they really are asking is not so much how am I going to support myself, but is there going to be journalism as I know it in the next 15, 20 years? Is the mainstream media, or are the mainstream media, all going to be superseded by other forms of independent communication, which people are still trying to figure out exactly how they're going to make money out of it? My concern about a Google or a Yahoo or AOL or any number of the kind of non-traditional media organizations coming into the business is that I often wonder whether they understand that part of the tradition of journalism, at least historically in this country, was not just to gather the news and report it, but also to defend the constitutional principles that made that possible. And it's no coincidence that many of the cases that were brought to the Supreme Court in the 1970s, 60s, 70s, and 80s that have now guaranteed things like all of our right to attend a public criminal trial were brought by news organizations. So I'd say that a lot of my students still have that kind of desire, that altruism, to try to ensure that we maintain those freedoms and that they play their part in that. But I think they are very nervous and very concerned about what what journalism is going to look like. And one of the things we often say to them is that if they decide to take an ethics course, for example, in journalism school, that it's very possible that when they end up in a newsroom, they're going to be one of the few, if not only, people in the room that has actually thought seriously about these ethical issues. Again, that is probably a reflection on what the one question was suggesting, that journalism, you know, doesn't have a set of ethical standards that are universally accepted. But my students are worried about journalism ethics, very concerned about it. They're concerned about the legal future, and they're worried about the economic future. And nevertheless, the ones that have that insatiable desire to ask questions, to go forth and to come back and report, are determined to do journalism, whatever that means, in 2030.
Well, thank goodness, huh? You have a question in the front here.
It's kind of a follow-up to his on Judith Miller, and I'm just wondering, what part does the merging of media outlets contribute to the, quote, lazy journalism of only seeking out official sources as the main source of a journalist that they rely upon? And I know that's kind of leading. What do you do to combat that?
Well, let's face it. I mean, there have always been lazy journalists, just as I'm sure there are lazy lawyers and lazy doctors. I mean, laziness is endemic, I think, in any trade. The great thing about journalism, though, and this is one thing that I think we can all kind of take heart on from, if we believe that these forms of new media communications are also journalism, they are holding the mainstream media's feet to the fire in a way that has really never happened before. The kind of monopoly that the mainstream media institutions had on the gathering and conveying of news, you know, literally, you know, the Star Tribune, the Pioneer Press would decide what news was in the Twin Cities. And if they didn't think it was news, it wouldn't be in the paper and you probably wouldn't hear about it. That's not the situation today. You've got many, many sources to go to, and I'm not just talking about radio and television, obviously. I also mean alternative sources, ethnic sources, the mainstream media, yes, but also online sources and bloggers and others. Having said that, and to say that there are other alternatives, and if, you know, if you have internet, you aren't even limited to U.S. outlets. You can go overseas. You can go around the world to whatever your source might be. The fact remains that when it comes to local reporting, you basically, I think, still need some kind of media institution that is dedicated to the proposition that we have reporters who become knowledgeable about a beat, who have an institutional memory, and yet still the curiosity and the desire to go out and challenge whatever the institutional or conventional wisdom might be. And I think that increasingly, when we see less competition in the media markets from among the mainstream media, it is very possible that the news media will become complacent. I will tell you something candidly, which is that when I moved here from Washington, D.C. in 1999, I had anticipated, I thought, why, I'm going to one of the few remaining metropolitan centers in the United States that has competing daily newspapers. There's the Pioneer Press and there's the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and boy, is that exciting to be in a place that has more than one daily newspaper. And I was very disappointed with what I found here. And that's, I'm talking about 1999. I'm not saying recently. Because the word you use, lazy, is the word that I would use. And I've said this to the people that have edited the papers through the years, so I'm not telling you a secret or speaking out against them for the first time. Because, again, they should have both been much better than they were, in my judgment. The competition should have made them better than they were. Whether all of these new media outlets that are now competing with the mainstream media are going to make them better than they have been, I think the jury is still out. If you talk to journalists who will point to, again, the merger of media companies, the sale of news organizations, particularly newspapers, to companies that have not traditionally been in the news business but in other kinds of business, they are concerned. They're scared, and they think that the world is going to change so profoundly that many of them, as you know, are taking buyouts and leaving the business rather than staying in as journalists. And I think that's a tragedy. I think it's a great loss. And I hope that when this whole economic upheaval finally resolves itself, that we'll be left with some independent media who have some understanding of the essential role that the press plays in democracy. But I have to be honest and say I'm not really optimistic that that's going to happen.
Back here.
Yes.
Maybe my question is just as pessimistic as as you concluded, but will we continue to have people like Cy Hirsch, who apparently no one in the administration will talk to Cy Hirsch, but he continues to have a great impact on what we know, and there are other journalists like that, but Cy is getting old, Nat Hentoff is getting old, and you're saying that your young journalists are worried about having any job at all. Mm-hmm. Will we have these great figures in the future?
I hope so. Obviously, I can't predict. I don't have a crystal ball to tell you, certainly. But I do think that what I alluded to before, kind of the insatiable desire to find out, you know, journalists as a group, I have to tell you, you might not fully appreciate this if your exposure to journalists is either limited to cable television or the Sunday morning Scream Fest or something. But, you know, most journalists are actually not terribly, I guess I would say, outgoing. And some of them are not exactly people that you would probably want to sit down and have coffee with. They tend to be people that are constantly looking for what's wrong. You know, we hear from some people in our government these days, you know, we're not hearing enough about all the good things that are happening in Iraq. Well, it's in the nature of journalism to really not care too much about the good things that are happening. Most journalists are constantly saying, what's going wrong? Where is the system failing us? How are we not getting the services that we expect and deserve? Or whatever the question might be. And this is not a character trait that endears those people to instruments of power and authority, or even sometimes to the general public. You know, time after time after time, we see people vilifying the press for exposing something in the classic case of shooting the messenger. And then, you know, weeks or months later, oh, yeah, you know, it was really good that the press actually told us that. It's a tough business. It's a tough thing to do, and it takes a fair amount of fortitude to pursue that as a career. I think it's a very small percentage of the total number of people that have practiced journalism that ever are a Nat Hentoff or Cy Hirsch, but I have no reason to think that any one generation has a monopoly on that. I think there are such people. I think they will come up. I think they will emerge, and I think we'll continue to see that kind of work.
Let us hope. Question right here.
Yes, this is too good an opportunity for me to miss. I have a question. I'm kind of a news junkie. I guess I would qualify as such. But one of the things that has bothered me, I think the press and our system here is so benefited by news and the openness on a relative basis that we have. One thing that's always troubled me, however, is in a system that is based a lot on checks and balances, mm-hmm. What about the news? When the publisher of the New York Times can make a decision as to publish the Pentagon Papers or whatever, something that carries a great, may have a great effect, he makes that decision. Mm-hmm. But nobody elected him or chose him, mm-hmm. and he doesn't really have a lot of a penalty to pay one way or the other. He can argue whether it sells papers or if it doesn't, or somebody might get angry at him. But are you troubled by that at all? Something that carries as much influence as people like that with no checks and balance?
I guess I would turn your question around by saying, would I be more troubled with the reverse situation? And I think that that's ultimately where we have to end up whenever we ask the question, the very important question you're asking. And I say this in part because I've been really lucky in my life to have spent a fair amount of time working in countries in Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet Union that have emerged from the years of the Soviet repression to embrace freedom of the press and freedom of information. Imperfectly, you know, from my perspective, but they're trying to do it. And you have only to talk to people that have grown up in those countries to understand in a really profound, significant way what it means when the government has the authority to control what the press can say. It is so easy, and it's so credible on some level, for a government to say, if you publish this, this will cause horrific damage to national security. Who would not take that comment seriously. Nobody I know. And if you go back and read not only some of the recent kind of editor's notes that have appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, but going back 20, 30 years to read things that Ben Bradley wrote, where he discussed how government officials, up to and including the President of the United States, would come to him and say, don't report this because the following is going to happen. And he has conceded, as have others, that there are times when indeed they are convinced by the government that it would be best if they withhold that information, and they do. So I think it's important to note that the idea that the press would just, you know, without thought, publish any piece of leaked or classified information that came their way is frankly incorrect. I don't know of anybody in journalistic circles, at least in the mainstream media, that would follow that. But by the same token, anybody who's in the business of covering government anywhere, not just here not just in Washington, but anywhere, knows that it is, again, so easy for the government to say the information you're about to report is going to cause terrible harm. The question the journalist always has to ask is, terrible harm to whom and to what interest? Because, you know, 9 times out of 10, this terrible harm has to do with embarrassment, cover-ups, trying to keep secret illegal activity, and has really nothing to do with the national security interest that is being brandished so easily. When I was in Romania some years ago, I was talking to some people that were actually not journalists, although this was part of a conference on freedom of expression in a free society. And one of the people in the audience, who I think was a trade unionist, raised his hand and he said, I have a question for you. How do we make the press tell the truth? And I thought that was a great question. Because deconstruct it a little bit. I mean, on the one hand, you've got the idea of how do we make the press do something, a very autocratic kind of idea that really doesn't have much currency in Western society, certainly not in the United States or Canada or the United Kingdom. But the other thing that I thought was even more interesting was the notion that there was a truth that you could make the press tell. What a wonderful idea. What a nice concept. And you're chuckling, what a crazy concept. But of course, if you've spent your life living in a country like Romania under the communist control, where the government and the press have been relentlessly telling you falsehood, then of course it stands to reason that you would want the 180 degrees opposite of that. But I think we know, and those who have lived in free societies know, that defining the truth is not that easy to do. And all we can do is try to strive for the greatest accuracy we can achieve at the time, recognizing that it may occur that sometime in the next week, month, year, we're going to find out we got the story entirely wrong. And also we may find that we maybe made a mistake in judgment. But frankly, I would not want to surrender that power to any governmental entity. Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. The nature of government is to be secretive and to control. The press is the last bastion we have against that.
Let's go first to the back and then in the center here.
There are two megaliths emerging in the East. They got independence roughly at the same time, one with a free press, one with one less so. I wonder if you'd care to comment on what's happening over there.
Well, I'd like to think, and I'm not an expert on the East, although I've spent some time in China and some other parts of that part of Asia. I would like to think that history is on the side of openness and democracy and participation. I mean, I'd like to think that it may not happen in my time, but that it will happen eventually. I know that when I've done work in China, I've gone, you know, been in Shanghai. I've gone to the newspapers that are controlled, as they all are in one extent to another, by the government, listen to the journalists. When I've been there, I've always had to be officially speaking about ethics in journalism because I'm not allowed to go and talk about a free press in that context. But then you go to a tea house and you talk to the journalists and you find out that they know what what a free press is supposed to be doing. They know that they shouldn't be controlled by the government, that they shouldn't be pursuing stories because the government tells them to, or not pursuing stories because the government says that they can't. And as we saw during the post-Soviet era, where, you know, not diminishing in any way the power of diplomacy and other kinds of political efforts, we can't also discount the fact that, hey, CNN was there, and suddenly people were seeing a view of the world that they had been forbidden to see and prevented to see for a long time. So I'm a believer that in the long run, the ubiquity of the Internet, the power of the media writ large, is going to continue to nurture what I think is the innate hunger in every people of every society to have free speech, free expression, freedom of thought, the freedom to pursue the things that they want to pursue. Again, may not happen in my time, but I think it is inevitable. About that, I'm optimistic.
The center here. Please.
A question arose about whether where the new generation of Cy Hirsches and Nat Hentoffs would come from.
Yes.
They're out there. Sometimes they're unheralded. Editor and publisher this month profiled the reporter who broke the story about the firing of the U.S. attorneys. She was a young reporter from McClatchy in the Washington Bureau, her first year in the Washington Bureau. She said, my advantage was I was not a Washington insider.
Right.
She covered the federal courts, so she knew what the role of a U.S. attorney is supposed to be. She was getting word from around the country about this, and she put it together, and she wrote a series of stories aided by bloggers. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, she broke it open because she knew how to do reporting that didn't rely on the attorney general or the Justice Department and the denials.
Mm-hmm.
So they're out there, and they find their way into print sometimes.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. That's an excellent example. The McClatchy Bureau is famous, at least among journalists, as being a Washington Bureau that doesn't fall in lockstep with the others. And, in fact, that's not the only story that they've broken over the years when others were, frankly, asleep at the switch. So thank you for reminding us of that.
In the back here, again.
The one of the questions I always had is how much influence does the owner and the advertisers exert in terms of what appears in the media, either press or television, radio, et cetera?
That's a complicated question, and I'm not sure that if you'd asked me that, you know, 5 years ago as opposed to today, if I would have answered it in exactly the same way. Going back to some of my friends from China, I remember meeting with some Chinese journalists about 10 or 12 years ago, and one of them said to me, how can you possibly say you have a free press in this country when it's commercial press that is subject to advertising dollars for its survival? And, you know, again, it goes back to how do you define a free press? If you define it as one that's free of government control, that's one thing, but she was defining it in a very different way. Historically, the position in journalistic circles as far as advertising is concerned has been that it's the separation of church and state. The people on the editorial side don't know who the advertisers are. They don't care to know who the advertisers are. They will cover their stories and cover their communities without fear or favor. In theory, that's the way it's supposed to work. In practice, I would be lying to you if I said that it always works that way, because it doesn't. And increasingly, you know, when you look at a newspaper, for example, that has, you know, special advertising supplements which are written by the newspaper staff, it becomes harder and harder to draw this distinction between advertising and reporting. But the best news outlets still strive to maintain that and to say, you know, quite literally, the advertising threatens to pull his or her dollars. If you do this story, well, the heck with them. We'll get another advertiser. The important thing is to do our stories and report to our readers. As far as the owner is concerned, that's a kind of a quaint question in a way, the way you phrase it, because it suggests the era of sort of, you know, Citizen Kane, with Charles Foster Kane deciding what his newspapers are going to do, or William Randolph Hearst, or any number of other powerful owners who were owners / journalist publishers who took a keen interest in exactly how and under what circumstances their reporters would cover stories. We really don't see much of that anymore, because that kind of powerful ownership presence is increasingly becoming, it's like the dodo. It's gone. Who are those who are running newspapers responsible to now? Shareholders. Wall Street. That's what they're responsible to, as shareholders are demanding greater and greater return and greater profits for their shares. And, you know, frankly, I have to say, and I'm betraying my age here, but I long for the era of the owner who would say, you know, Colonel Robert McCormick for the Chicago Tribune, for example. Politically, not exactly my cup of tea, but his commitment to journalism and to everything journalism stands for, you know, impeccable. So, and the paper in the town I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, owned by Eugene Pulliam, another name of somebody who some people thought the politics were slightly to the right of Attila the Hun, but boy, did he believe in freedom of the press and the First Amendment. And sometimes people ask me, where did you get your zeal about this? And I said, reading the papers in Indianapolis growing up, because I believe that he believed and his staff believed in this idea of reporting vigorously and without fear or favor. Sadly, the Indianapolis Star today doesn't look anything like it did when I was growing up. The Pulliam children sold off the paper. It's now a Gannett paper and interchangeable with just about any other Gannett paper in the country. And, again, I'm very sorry to see that.
Tony, is there a question in the center here? Yes, please.
Yes, you.
Thank you. I heard probably on Frontline recently that 70% of the cost of putting out a newspaper is the printing and distribution. I was horrified. It made me wonder about the tail wagging the dog, maybe, or how you would describe that. Can you comment, please, on that accuracy and any ramifications you think of?
Well, I think it is correct, and I think what is significant about this, and again, this is something that you know, years ago I became really aware of, not back when I was a reporter, but when I started working in these emerging democracies, and found out what a tremendous impediment it is to doing journalism in a traditional sense. If you have to buy reams of newspaper, you have to buy printing presses, you have to have a distribution system set up, this is incredibly expensive. It really is. And so it does not surprise me that that figure is quoted. I have no reason to dispute it or to doubt that it's accurate. What's significant, though, is that gradually news organizations, newspapers, let's say, for the purposes of simplicity, are starting to realize that the old traditional way of delivering the news is not only incredibly expensive, but it's rapidly becoming obsolete. You were asking about my students, and I will tell you honestly that the vast majority of my students, journalism majors, never read a daily newspaper in the paper form. They can't imagine doing that. They just don't do it. They go online. And so you see that in a way, this could be, if they would only embrace it, this could be the salvation of the mainstream media, because guess what they can eliminate? All that cost of printing, distributing the conventional kind of newspaper. But, of course, there's still those of us, and I suspect a few of you in this room are like this, who like the tactile sensation of picking up a newspaper. And we're going to have to figure out how we're going to resolve this dilemma. But I think with time, you know, it will be. And so although I think the quote is true for now, I suspect that it will not be in another 5 or 10 years.
One question over here. Somebody's got a mic there, Margie?
Yeah. Oh, here.
Oh, thank you. Here you are. Sorry, couldn't see you.
What do you think of the journalism of Fox News and Bill O'Reilly?
Well, let me say this about any of the cable pundits, or for that matter, somebody like Rush Limbaugh. I think many of them would probably say that what they're doing is not journalism in the traditional sense, at least not in the way I defined it, of gathering information, doing your best to be accurate and complete, to provide context and to distribute that to the public. I don't think Bill O'Reilly's doing that, and I don't think he would say that he's doing that. I don't think Rush Limbaugh would say he's doing that. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't tremendously influential and don't have a following and don't have people who look to them as their gurus, but that still doesn't make them, in my definition, journalists. As far as Fox is concerned, it's difficult for me to respond to that because of my own bad experiences with Fox when I was at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. I was in a position where, you know, I was basically defending the press all the time. I wasn't supposed to deal with ethical issues. I was just talking about First Amendment issues. So obviously I was almost always saying, you know, the press was right and had the right to do what it wanted to do. But my own experience with Fox, at least Fox Cable, I can't speak really so much for the over-the-air stuff, and in fact I should save. I'm really not. But for Fox Cable, I had the experience on multiple occasions of being asked to go on Fox to talk about X topic, and I would say, well, you know, that's fine. I'll be happy to talk about that. But, you know, because of the job I have, the position my organization takes, I can't talk about why. So if you need to talk about why, then you need to get somebody else. I'd be happy to recommend someone else, but it can't be me. Oh, no, Ms. Kirtley, we're not going to talk about why. We'll just talk about X. Then they get you in the chair. They put in the earpiece. They put on the phone. And what do they ask you about? Why? And after that happened to me about three times, I said, I'm not going to do Fox anymore because I'm not going to deal with people that lie to me. Now, I'm not saying that Fox lies to you, but I am saying that for me, the credibility of the operation was seriously undermined by that. But with that comment, do I think that a news organization has an obligation to have no point of view or no perspective? And I think the answer to that is in the cable realm, where it is possible, although sometimes lost on the public, to make a distinction between the straight news coverage and the editorial or opinion kind of things, I think it's perfectly appropriate for a cable channel, just like a newspaper, to choose to have a point of view in its editorial side. I have no problem with that. I may disagree with the view that they take. And, you read the Wall Street Journal and take your pick between the news pages and the editorial pages. You're going to see, I think some of us would say, a disconnect. But I think that's fine. I don't have any problem with that, as long as everybody's clear that this is opinion and this is reporting. I think that's fine.
Question in front here.
I'd like to hear
thanks.
Your opinion or your experiences with the development of a free press in, I assume, developing democracies, whether in the various countries they develop in a parallel sort of way, or are there a number of different models that are developing?
I think there are a lot of differences, but to really grossly oversimplify it, because this we could talk for hours about this. I would say that the big distinction I see is between countries that have had some tradition of a democratic system, maybe going back years, but they had it at some point, and those that have never had that. In the ones that have had some democratic experience, and I'm thinking again of a country like Romania, which for a period of time between the wars actually did have a democratic system, it's easier, I think, to kind of go back, find the first principles, and make it possible to embrace doctrines like freedom of the press. In more autocratic societies, whether they were communist or some other form of autocratic government where that has not been experienced, I think there's more caution, shall we say, suspicion, worry about, kind of, frankly, what was alluded to, which is an out-of-control press that will report not just national security, but will trample over people's reputations, and there will be absolutely no piper to pay because they'll be saying, freedom of the press, I should be able to do whatever I want. The other interesting thing that I found in one country that I visited was that by no means were journalists necessarily prepared to say the rights that I enjoy as a journalist should be extended to journalists that are representing, for example, opposition media. I used to be in the opposition, but now I'm not anymore. So quick, let's legislate to curtail the rights of my competitors. And sometimes the naivete of that, you know, you have to address just by saying, you know, if your country is really going to be a democracy, guess what? The day is going to come where you're the opposition press, too. And out of self-interest, if nothing else, you really don't want to see that kind of legislation enacted. oh, I mean, this is like a moment of shock and surprise. And, you know, actually it occurs here in this country too, but I've seen it in emerging democracies as well. But I guess the most pernicious thing that I've seen in countries where there's at least an attempt to try to establish a free press is that I've had mostly government officials, but sometimes journalists themselves say, freedom of the press is a great idea, but we're just not quite ready for it yet. When we're a more mature democracy, then we can afford a free press, but right now we can't. And I'm sure you can predict what my answer to that is, which is you are never going to be a mature democracy if you don't have a free press.
See, we have a question over here. Good.
May I ask a why question?
Sure.
Thank you. You mentioned the House of Cards fell in.
Right.
Why do you think it happened now? Was it the courts? Was it Patrick Fitzgerald? A number of factors?
I think it's a lot of different factors. And if I had to put it on one, I would say, yeah, it's the courts. I say this as somebody who is an ardent supporter of an independent judiciary and really believe that the courts are the last bastion that we all have against the other branches of government running amok. So with that qualifier, I think that we now have a generation of judges in place that simply doesn't think that the role of the press is essential to a democratic system. They are unhappy with what they see the press doing, and they seem to be unable to do as some of their predecessors did, to draw a distinction between the conduct that they don't like and the principle that they as judges need to support. So I think that's part of it. I think there's also, frankly, an erosion of public support for the press. I mean, contrast the way most people regard the mainstream media today with the way many people at least regarded the media in the post-Watergate era. I mean, journalists were heroes for that halcyon period of time. You know, people wanted to go to journalism school. They wanted their kids to become journalists. Everybody thought this was great. Well, that doesn't exist really anymore. And I think while I wouldn't suggest that Fitzgerald was engaging in his actions because he was conspiring to undermine the press, I think it couldn't have escaped his notice that the public support and the public outrage at the notion of jailing a journalist simply, you know, wasn't at the same level as it might have been in the 1970s. So it's a combination, I think, of lots of different things. There are those who believe that, you know, those in the current administration have been very deliberately trying to undermine press credibility. Whether that's true or not, you know, whether it's them, the right, the left, you know, who knows? The press have also shot themselves in the foot often enough that I'm not going to lay the blame at any particular place. But I do think, again, going back to my original answer to your question, that I think we have a generation of judges now who simply doesn't regard the role of the press as so central to democracy that it needs to be protected.
Jane, a question. I think this is for the editorial writer in you. Who are the journalists that you admire the most these days?
Oh heavens, what a question! You know, because there are so many people that I admire, but I guess if you're asking me who do I read regularly, whenever I go to the WashingtonPost.com website, I'm always looking for Dana Priest's stories. I look at her weekly commentary where she has a chat. I admire her work tremendously. I think that she does wonderful things courageously without fear of favor. So if I had to pick a person who I try to read without fail, it would be Dana Priest.
Thank you. Well, as always, you've asked some wonderful questions and really made this a very, very rich evening for all of us, I think. But, Jane, we're so proud to have you part of the University of Minnesota and so pleased that you would come and share your expertise with us tonight on this really important topic. Huh?
Well, thank you all for coming tonight, too. I appreciate
it. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Well, once again, I really thank you for being part of a really terrific season. And I want you to know that the person who created the series and has really managed the whole thing is right up here. It's Margie Ligon. So thanks to her. She
she truly has a wonderful staff. We're fortunate to have many in CCE that are really helping behind the scenes as well. So I thank all of them. I hope you have seen the little survey on the table, and if you haven't filled it out, I hope you will. Give us a little feedback about headliners. And then if you have a few more minutes, and maybe 20, 25, 30 minutes to spare, we'd love to hear a little bit more with you in kind of a more conversational setting, and also trot out another idea that we've got for programming that may begin in the fall. We'd love to have your ideas and help in shaping that. So, well, once again, I thank you all for being part of this tonight and other nights earlier in the season, and we'll look forward to kicking off another season of Headliners in the fall. Thanks very much.